Studio 360.
On today's show, we are serving up three of our favorite American icon segments. And to begin, it's Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter. That, of course, is his 1850 novel about a woman being shamed for getting pregnant adulterously. Anna Sale produced that story in 2013. And even though it's only 4 years old, it resonates differently now, as the country is engulfed in news stories every day about sexual misconduct, and we are all engaged in new twists and turns in that national conversation. Anna is now the host of the excellent podcast Death, Sex, and Money, and she is on the line with me. Hello, Anna.
Hi, Kurt.
Do you remember as a young person when you first read The Scarlet Letter?
I think I read it in high school. And, you know, what I remember at the time was, of course, like, this is a story about the treacherous road that women have to navigate about how to be honorable. That's sort of what I remember being a young woman reading it at the time was, you know, you've got to not get in trouble or you'll be publicly shamed. And if you are publicly shamed, you hold the shame alone.
Right.
You don't drag anyone else down with you.
Right. And did you think at the time, if you can recall, like, whoa, those 1640s, that was a tough time. Today, there's no shame.
I don't think I ever thought that. I mean, I knew, like, even as a 14-year-old that I wanted to be seen as both attractive to boys and for them not to get the wrong idea about the kind of girl I was. I knew that was a line I had to walk.
Yeah. So it is obviously a story about sex and society and scandals and shaming. When you did this piece in 2013, around that same time, you were covering the Anthony Weiner scandal. What was that on your mind as you were doing this Scarlet Letter piece?
Yeah, I was looking at the dates. I was like, wow, that was all happening at the same time. So weird. But I think even in the Anthony Weiner scandal, it felt different to me than the Scarlet Letter because there was such a power imbalance in a way with the young women that he was texting with and sexting with. You know, you could make that argument with Hester Prynne, how it was the town reverend, but I don't think it was precisely the same thing.
Well, let's listen to this piece and then we'll talk a bit more on the other side. Here is our American icon on The Scarlet Letter, produced and reported by Anna Sale.
The Scarlet Letter opens with Hester Prynne stepping out of prison to a crowd of gawking townspeople. She's young, she's beautiful, and she has a baby in her arms.
Hester Prynne, you have been found guilty of adultery. We are loath to invoke the full penalty of the law.
This is from a 1934 movie version.
So if you would have us be merciful, reveal the name of him that tempted you.
No.
She gets a life sentence of shame. The Scarlet Letter was published in 1850, but it's still there, everywhere, in any conversation about sex, illicit desire, and humiliation. And it's one of those references you can throw around for literary cred, like in this Taylor Swift song that mashes together Hawthorne and Shakespeare. It's shown up on The Simpsons and Roseanne. There was a modern riff with Emma Stone as a high schooler with a bad reputation. It was also on Twin Peaks.
Hester Prynne, pretty name.
During the interrogation of a prostitute.
I read The Scarlet Letter in high school just like you did.
I read it like most of American teenagers in a high school English class.
Tom Perrott is the author of a number of novels about sex and sexual politics in suburbia. Election, The Abstinence Teacher, Little Children. He hadn't read the book since he was a teenager, but he picked it up again before we spoke.
I actually loved it this time. It's a little bit unhinged, and I feel like they're just these unruly sexual energies that the book is like really struggling to keep clamped down. And I think I just clamped them down enough that as a teenager, I miss that. And as an adult, I see it and was really struck by the kind of contained craziness of it.
I remember feeling like it was weirdly sexy. I remember feeling sort of feminist about it.
Lindy West is a staff writer at Jezebel.
It's a very clear demonstration of the arbitrariness of a lot of morality and the way that that disproportionately affects women. So I remember feeling as a woman that this was something I should be paying attention to.
It's about a single mother. I mean, what could be more relevant, really?
Brenda Wineapple is the author of a biography of Nathaniel Hawthorne.
She's what they used to call a fallen woman.
Fallen, and she's kind of proud of it.
She took the baby on her arm, and with a burning blush and yet a haughty smile and a glance that would not be abashed, looked around at her townspeople and neighbors. On the breast of her gown, in fine red cloth, surrounded with an elaborate embroidery and fantastic flourishes of gold thread, appeared the letter A.
That's a kind of shocking image, I think. And then it becomes about what that means to her, what that means to her child, what that means to her lover, what it means to her husband, what it means to the community. And there are all these very different points of view about what that means, and they kind of change over time.
So the sin is out there, but what Hester won't reveal is the father's name.
"I will not speak," answered Hester, turning pale as death, but responding to this voice, which she too surely recognized. "And my child must seek a heavenly father. She shall never know an earthly one."
But the reader knows. It's the town minister, Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale. He's there at Hester's sentencing. Publicly, he urges her to name the father. Privately, he's a mess.
Arthur Dimmesdale, sodden with guilt.
That's Peter Coviello. He teaches English at Bowdoin College, and he's written about sex in 19th century literature.
Just Hawthorne's great expression of someone just riven by a kind of self-horror that he can't work out.
And preyed on, and preyed upon.
The person preying upon Dimmesdale is the other man in the book, Roger Chillingworth. He's Hester's husband, a much older man. He arrives in town to find Hester with her illegitimate baby. He pretends to be a physician and discovers Dimmesdale is the father. But he doesn't let on. Instead, Chillingworth manipulates Dimmesdale's insecurities to deepen his shame.
As he proceeded, a terrible fascination, a kind of fierce, though still calm, necessity seized the old man within its grip and never set him free again until he had done all its bidding. He now dug into the poor clergyman's heart like a miner searching for gold, or rather, like a sexton delving into a grave.
That love triangle between Hester Prynne, Arthur Dimmesdale, and Roger Chillingworth pulses through the romantic text.
Sex is always there. There's a kind of erotic overtone or undertone with Chillingworth and Dimmesdale.
This is a super queer book. The erotics of Chillingworth's really outsized and impassioned investment in Dimmesdale and his destruction is, in certain ways, the larger romance of the book.
Where it's not clear really who's after who and who's interested in whom, and that's all eroticized as well. Very sexy.
Like on the night the three come across each other in town and a meteor flashes across the sky.
"If the meteor kindled up the sky and disclosed the earth with an awfulness that admonished Hester Prynne and the clergyman of the day of judgment, then might Roger Chillingworth have passed with them for the arch-fiend, standing there with a smile and scowl to claim his own." So vivid was the expression, or so intense the minister's perception of it, that it seemed still to remain painted on the darkness after the meteor had vanished.
The Scarlet Letter has that sense of the claustrophobia of a small town, the sense of being watched by people you know all the time. Hawthorne knew that feeling. He was living in his hometown, Salem, where one of his ancestors was a judge at the Salem witch trials. So the Puritans were on Hawthorne's mind, even as some modern ideas about women were starting to take shape. Hawthorne biographer Brenda Wineapple says Hawthorne was right in the middle of it.
For a while, one of his very close friends was a very strong and sexual and outspoken woman named Margaret Fuller.
Fuller was a pioneer of what came to be feminism. She wrote a book that inspired the landmark Seneca Falls Conference on Women's Rights, which happened just before The Scarlet Letter was published. But to tell his story about a woman exploring the boundaries of personal freedom, Hawthorne looked back all the way to the 1600s.
Somehow those present issues became more real for him and more exciting if they were projected past.
Out of all this, Hawthorne created Hester Prynne.
She has no precedent. There is no American literature. There is no American heroine before her.
And Hawthorne had conflicted feelings about Hester.
She's forced into a position of infamy because she's pregnant, because she's an unwed mother, because she had to tryst in the woods with a minister. Not a good thing. And yet at the same time, she chose to go.
It's a strange book. It can't deal with sex, and yet it's creating the groundwork for a sexual revolution.
Again, novelist Tom Perata.
I think the thing that makes it so American and is the thing that makes it modern too, though it's hard to see that, is that the real crime isn't desire, it's hypocrisy. And I think that's a specific American view of sex.
The Scarlet Letter's sexiest scene comes when Hester Prynne and Arthur Dimmesdale meet again, this time away from Chillingworth's watchful eye. Hester and Pearl are on a walk, and the child runs ahead. That's when Hester sees Reverend Dimmesdale walk past her, and she calls to him.
So strangely did they meet in the dim wood that it was like the first encounter in the world beyond the grave of two spirits who had been intimately connected in their former life, but now stood coldly shuddering in mutual dread.
The one-time lovers, at first, have no idea what to say to each other.
When they found voice to speak, it was, at first, only to utter remarks and inquiries such as any two acquaintances might have made about the gloomy sky, the threatening storm, and, next, the health of each. Thus they went onward, not boldly, but step by step, into the themes that were brooding deepest in their hearts.
Hester reveals to Dimmesdale that his friend Chillingworth is her husband. Dimmesdale decides to leave town, and Hester says she'll go with him. They'll flee, start a new life together, and live happily ever after. And then the scene that the late novelist John Updike called one of the great moments in American fiction in an interview with NPR a year before he died.
First, she throws away the Scarlet Letter.
Hester tosses the Scarlet A aside.
Oh, exquisite relief. She had not known the weight until she felt the freedom. By another impulse, she took off the formal cap that confined her hair, and down it fell upon her shoulders, dark and rich, with at once a shadow and a light in its abundance, and imparting the charm of softness to her features.
How wonderful the power of the hair, the mystery of the long hair let down.
John Updike wrote a trilogy based on The Scarlet Letter, each book retold from the perspective of one of the major characters. His 1988 book, S, is from Hester's point of view.
She's such an arresting and slightly ambiguous figure. She's a funny mix of a truly liberated, defiantly sexual and independent woman, but in the end, a woman who accepts the penance that society imposed on her. I suppose she's an epitome of female predicaments.
You know the female predicaments, the questions about how to get what you want within a tangle of obligations and expectations. Hester wants to be with her lover, and she loves him by protecting him. Those predicaments are still here, says Lindy West of Jezebel.
We're still dealing with these issues now, and this was something that Hawthorne was criticizing in the mid-19th century. That's pretty discouraging, actually.
And that's why the term Scarlet Letter is still ubiquitous.
I guess we use it as a shorthand for what we call slut-shaming now, which is blaming women for their own sexuality and turning that into a moral failing.
Lindy West pays a lot of attention to the contradictions in how people talk about women and sex on the internet. On the one hand, she says there's consensus that it's okay for American women to have sex lives. But if you want to condemn or humiliate a woman, go online and point out she has a sex life.
There are so many outlets to shame people for their behavior, to post pictures, naked pictures, or post details of people's personal lives that they don't want shared. It makes the stakes higher for everyone because it's not just hearsay anymore. People can bring up actual evidence. But on the flip side of that, the internet's also amazing in terms of women finding solace in community. I mean, Hester Prynne would probably have loved having a Tumblr. I mean, I think that could have really helped her out.
And the internet can also be a tool of revenge. Lindy West has become a kind of watchdog, and she brings a certain level of glee to taking on digital bullies.
People have figured out that we can use the same tactics to shame the shamers. If they say something horrible to me, I will retweet it with their face attached to it, and then all of my hilarious female friends will make fun of them. I mean, I will crush them.
Almost like Roger Chillingworth wanted to crush Arthur Dimmesdale.
Now I'm confused. Because isn't he the villain? Well, anyway, I guess I do. I am fueled by revenge. But my revenge is justified because they started it.
Hester Prynne may still be our archetype for a woman acting on her desires. But in the end, she doesn't get what she wants. Dimmesdale just can't follow through on their plans to flee together.
And of course, he can't do it. I mean, he's the same man he always was, and he was never able to be strong. But I think that Hawthorne is saying that's not a great thing to do anyway, because that would be another shirking of a kind of responsibility. These people have a responsibility to the community. They can't just take off.
When Tom Perata was writing his novel Little Children, he retold that story.
I suddenly realized, you know, there's a scene in Little Children where the adulterous lovers are on a football field and they commit to running away together.
Run away with me.
This is from the movie version.
What?
Starring Kate Winslet and Patrick Wilson.
Wait, you don't mean that.
You believe in me.
But, you know, they have to make some arrangements. And, of course, in the intervening space, the man loses heart and finds that the courage leaks away. And so it really is a kind of clear reference back to this scene in The Scarlet Letter that I thought I had forgotten. But I think it's that kind of book. It becomes part of America's collective unconscious and certainly American novelists' unconscious.
In The Scarlet Letter, Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale does eventually confess his sins and promptly dies of a heart attack. Hester and Pearl leave town. But at the end of the book, Hester returns. She lives out her life there, becoming a kind of advisor to local women, talking about their troubles and love. All the while, she wears the Scarlet A.
In the lapse of the toilsome, thoughtful, and self-devoted years that made up Hester's life, The Scarlet Letter ceased to be a stigma which attracted the world's scorn and bitterness, and became a type of something to be sorrowed over, and looked upon with awe, yet with reverence too.
Hester is buried next to Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale. This book is all about the tension between public shaming and public accountability. Nathaniel Hawthorne intimately details the inner lives of the transgressors and the enforcers, their individual motivations and hurts. But he's never totally clear on how he feels about the transgression. In this drama that centers on community judgments, Hawthorne withholds his.
I think the frustrating part of him is what's the wonderful part of him, and that is he's very brilliant, and he won't take a stand.
Hawthorne has a lot of stuff that's disquieting. He just kind of holds out here. This is discomforting and unsettling. Let's look at it for a while.
It's our anxiety. He induces anxiety in us, and we want to keep coming back and trying to understand.
I've been loving you.
That piece first aired in 2013. Excerpts from the story were read by Amanda Quaid. Lindy West is now a contributing opinion editor for the New York Times and last year published a memoir called Shrill, Notes from a Loud Woman. Peter Coviello now teaches at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And Anna Sale, of course, is now the host of the excellent podcast Death, Sex, and Money. And she is on the line with me now. And as I was listening to that, I wondered, like, there must be hundreds, if not thousands, or maybe even millions of essentially Dimmesdales of a sort around America now waiting to be outed by their, charitably speaking, for the man, Hester Prynne.
Yeah. And I, you know, listening back, when you hear that Arthur Dimmesdale does eventually confess and promptly dies of a heart attack, it's just sort of like it leaves open that question of, can a man who did wrong, can he find redemption?
Yeah.
The thing that I don't remember being as conscious of is the question of why Hester protects the reverend that she had the affair with. It's just something that's unquestioned. It's like, that's part of what you're expected to do. She's going to protect the offender. And I think that's what I think about a lot about this moment we're in right now, is that seems to be crumbling, that feeling that the risk is too high to name someone who has done something to you. Of course, in The Scarlet Letter, as far as we know, it was a consensual affair, which is very different.
Well, and the consensual nature, the technically consensual nature, or the consensual nature of it, reminds me, in fact, more than the things that are being exposed lately, of Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. Now that I and we are recasting our glance at Clinton and what he did.
Yeah. And I, you know, talking to you, Kurt, has made me want to go back and do a critical reading of The Scarlet Letter and to analyze the power dynamic between Hester and Arthur Dimmesdale, because I think it's like, that's a thing that we're grappling with now, is like, what is consensual? You know, we've had an agreement that if you're a minor with someone who is of legal age, that can't be consensual. But when you look at community power and you look at workplace power, and you look at who is the aggressor in creating a sexual relationship, those are all questions we're digging in a little more deeply now in contemporary America. And I didn't look at that power dynamic as closely, I think, when I reread it 4 years ago when I was working on this piece. I'd like to think about that some more.
One of my commonplace, oh, here we are, feelings about America in the 21st century is, like, there is no more shame. Shameful behavior does not result in sufficient shame, the conservative little me often said. But at least in this instance, in this spectrum of misbehavior the last 2 months, that ain't true.
No, not true at all. It's like, it's interesting to see what institutions and companies and people who are trying to make money, like, there seem to be a real cost to be associated with someone who has either been found to be or alleged to have been some kind of perpetrator or predator. And there's real fast justice happening right now. I'm encouraged by it in some ways, because I think it shows how long we thought that there weren't means to find this kind of justice. I'm doing just a lot of reflecting and thinking about this new world we live in and how long it's going to last and what the consequences are, and if this is a moment or if this is a new paradigm.
All those things. As somebody who began your career and continued your career in public media, public radio specifically, was the fact of NPR's head of the news, Michael Oreskes, being so swiftly booted when his misconduct was exposed. Were you particularly, oh my God, here among my tribe, this is also happening? Did you have that feeling?
Yeah, of course. You know, I was a young woman reporter in newsrooms and public media newsrooms, seeking out the advice of older men. And I think of those mentors with great affection. And to think that was violated for women just like me, I found completely and totally heartbreaking. It felt very close.
Well, and that the good men of the kind who presumably mentored you and young women seeking such mentorship, that's, I would think, not happening as freely as it did some weeks ago.
Yeah, I think people are probably having a lot fewer work meetings over drinks right
now.
Yeah. And maybe that's okay.
Yep. Anna Sale, this has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anna Sale is the host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money.